Good afternoon, everybody. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona, and we're here with another of our virtual events. And tonight, this evening, we're delighted to have our friend Leonard Goldberg back with us to talk about his brand new book, The Blue Diamond. And Leonard, as always, signed a batch of books for us, so you can see the signature. And I'll go ahead and put a link in the comments field. We don't have that many left. So if you'd like to purchase an autographed copy, I'll put the link in the comments field. And if you have questions for Leonard or Barbara, go ahead and put them in and Barbara will summon me back on screen towards the end of the hour. So Barbara, over to you.
Thank you very much, Patrick. Good evening, everyone. Leonard, what a pleasure to see you again.
My pleasure, Barbara.
So I'd like to say before we start that I've just had my annual eye exam and therefore I'm not stoned, although frankly I wish I were, but I'm just suffering from having my eyes dilated. And, you know, thinking back, though, I mean, we're in 1917 and, you know, Sherlock Holmes and Watson, the originals, were back in, what, the 1890s, I think, that people didn't have the luxury of eye exams. If your eyes went bad, there you were. In fact, do you remember the movie Kim? Ages ago, Leonard? I mean, I'm trying to remember. It was made, Lord, I can't remember how far back.
I don't.
But in the process of Kim, which is, you know, the Rudyard Kipling, it was probably made in the 50s, that the little boy, Kim, his elderly Indian that is helping him survive and so forth, can't see. And the great gift that he gets at the end is a pair of spectacles, so the old man can kind of see where he's going. So, you know, I'm grateful. It came up the other day at some event we were doing, about whether, you know, the question was, would you like to travel back and live in the past, or would you like to travel back and just look at someplace in the past as an observer, minding all the rules about not changing anything? And the unanimous choice of that group was just to look at everything, because they couldn't figure out how many modern things they would have to pack if they were going to actually go back and live in the past.
I recall back when cataract surgery required the patient to lay flat in bed for a week after the surgery. And even after the healing, they were given a pair of glasses, which lenses so thick, they look like Coca-Cola bottles.
Yep.
And now you go in, you have the lens removed and a new one put in. Takes about 20 minutes and then you're good to go. Quite remarkable.
It is remarkable. And in my case, just to complete this medical saga before we talk about the book, you can choose telescoping lenses. So in point of fact, it's like having glasses implanted in your eyes. So yeah. I can read signs way across the room and I can read the text of the book way up here when my eyes aren't dilated. So I consider that to be truly miraculous as a person who went into glasses when I think I was like 10. You know, I still, every once in a while, I still hit my face, you know, because I think they're there. I wore them for so many years. So the daughter of Sherlock Holmes, we're in 1917. So we're in the war here.
Yes, we're in the middle of the war, and it's a dire time for the Allied forces. Things are not going well at all. The battle at Ypres has just concluded, with 300,000 Allied soldiers killed, wounded, or missing. It's a disaster. And the German forces are moving towards Paris in such a fashion that the French are now considering moving their capital to Bordeaux. So it is not a good time for the Allied forces.
And you wind up with a mission being sent to London.
Yes, the British government depended a great deal on the Allies, particularly from the Dominion. And perhaps one ally or Dominion which gave Britain the most help was South Africa. South Africa not only provided a large number of troops, but a great deal of the raw materials necessary for production of war instruments came from South Africa. In any event, with the war not going well, there was a conference being held in London. The Imperial War Conference, in which all of the Dominion members were coming in, the Commonwealth members. And the Governor General of South Africa was bringing with him a magnificent blue diamond of almost 3,000 carats. It was flawless. And the Governor General was to present this flawless diamond to the King of England to show the resolute alliance that he and all the other Commonwealth members have to the war effort. And the Governor General is housed at the Windsor Hotel on the penthouse floor. It's closed off. Nobody is allowed on that floor except for members of the Governor General's entourage. He goes to sleep the night before he's to present the blue diamond to the king. And when he awakes in the morning, the blue diamond is gone.
So you created a locked room mystery. Oh, wow. A classic detective fiction, right?
Yes, I had a good time with this one. And again, it's a closed door kind of mystery. Like, how did it happen? How in the world could this occur? All the doors were locked, all the windows locked, yet someone somehow managed to enter and steal a blue diamond whose value was incredible, beyond numbers. So the Scotland Yard is called in, and the hotel people are just upset as can be, because this is not the first major robbery which has occurred in London at fashionable hotels. Over the past several weeks, there have been other robberies, which included the theft of a Ming vase, which dates back to the first dynasty. Its value is £1 million. Then there was the theft of bearer bonds from one of America's great industrialists. And Scotland Yard has to find out who's doing it, because the hoteliers are in panic. This is a blemish. They can't have it. And unfortunately, Scotland Yard inspectors are unable to solve the mystery. So Joanna and the Watsons are called in.
Naturally, I mean, who better than the daughter of Sherlock Holmes? You know, it's an interesting question. There have been books, I'm trying to remember the author, it's a terrific book called Blackout, in which there's John, it'll come to me in a minute, his name starts with an L. Patrick will help me out here in a minute with the chat function. But anyway, the point of Blackout is, how do you police a city during wartime, especially when most of the, you know, the serving policemen and all have gone off to fight? Now, this is World War II, when the Blitz is going on, and London is, so unsafe. But there are still people. Oh, John Lawton, thank you very much, Patrick. It's really a terrific book. What do you do when there's a murder or a string of murders in a city that, where bombs are dropping all around and people are terrified and most of the police force is off at the front or doing whatever they're doing? So World War I, you don't have that problem in the sense that London is not actually being invaded. And I don't think, is there a lot of bombing in World War I? I mean, it was also new, air warfare. There were fights in the sky, but did the Germans rain much down on London?
A fair amount, actually. It was kind of interesting. The reason I researched this is because I read a book, which you're probably familiar with, about Churchill's history during the early part of World War II. The book title was The Splendid and the Vile.
Right.
It really went into details about how the London Blitz in the 1940s affected everything. So I thought to myself, well, surely there must have been some bombing during World War I of England and London in particular. So I looked it up, and it was quite revealing. First of all, initially, the bombs were sent over in these blimps, Zeppelins. Mm-hmm. But the Germans found out that they were too easy to shoot down, and they only travel at 50 miles an hour, whatever. So then they went to the biplanes, which were motored by Messerschmitt engines, could travel 100 miles an hour, which was very fast, and could carry payloads of 4,000 pounds of explosives. So they bombed London, mainly to frighten the people, of course, but they also bombed the surrounding areas, cities like Birmingham, where there was a huge munition factory. Mm-hmm. And they had some air fights and what have you, but it was mainly a give and take. And England also sent bombers over to Germany. And the reality is that the public in London did not have a great warning system back then. The blimps, of course, were silent, but the bombers had a drone-like sound, so you could hear them approaching, but only when they went there. So they had an alert system in which the lookouts or what have you would detect the sound of the coming bombers. And then a constable on a bicycle would ride through the neighborhood, yelling at the top of his voice, "Take cover, take cover." That was their warning system.
Well, I mean, obviously they were making up a lot because the air warfare was so new, you know, the planes, the bombs, the whole thing. But my point was, you know, that if this is all going on here in the Blue Diamond during the war, and if how do you function as a police force? You know, how do you actually solve these robberies? So Lestrade, this is the son of Lestrade, right?
Yes.
You know, so why isn't he off in France? Has he been wounded? Is it considered an occupation that saves him from the draft if he's, you know, policing with Scotland Yard? What's the deal with him?
I believe, although I didn't include it in the novel, that number one, it was his age. He's getting a little older now. And number two is that there were certain people who were immune, if you will, to the draft. Yeah. And these included, for example, people in Scotland Yard, because as you mentioned earlier, during wartime, criminals can have a field day, a literal field day, because Scotland Yard is diminished in force and number and what have you. So in reality, they had to make certain that a certain number of police or detectives or constables were around to maintain the peace. And I suspect that's what happened to Lestrade.
So how old is Joanna and her? I mean, she wouldn't have been necessarily called to serve, although plenty of British women did sign up to drive ambulances and do all kinds of jobs. But what about her husband? I mean, obviously the original Watson is way too old here, but what about her husband?
Well, it's kind of interesting. He was a physician. And back in those days, they didn't send physicians to the front.
Right.
Number two is that not in this novel, but in the coming novel, you will see that young John Watson also played a role in the war, and that he was an expert in the effects of mustard gas poisoning.
Ah.
And he had done research and questioned the people who had been poisoned and survived, and was considered somebody of real value on the home front. So he was kept home for that regard. But again, it wasn't like a MASH unit or you see physicians at the front. There were very few of them up there, although they were there. But the ones of high status, such as John Watson, I think, were left home for good reason.
Well, I mean, you know, basically you still have to have somebody to run the country at home. As I said, you have to have policing. You certainly need medical people to, you know, people still are getting sick. It's not just the war wounded. Although I just read I'm trying to remember whether it's called Facemaker or whatever, a book just out about plastic surgery, about, you know, the terrible wounds that trench warfare in particular from snipers and other things that soldiers would sustain, and especially to their faces, which, I mean, many of them had their faces basically destroyed, and it gave rise to enormous advances in plastic surgery to try to help these people, you know, many of whom were suffering from shell shock and so forth, but they didn't get a lot of sympathy because people were so repelled by, you know, the absence of their faces, or their jaws were blown off and they couldn't eat, or, you know, all kinds of horrible things. And it was really a fascinating book to read, although I think some of it began in the Civil War. It seemed to me, I can recall that there were snipers in the Civil War, and one of the problems was that the guns, you know, would blow up and the sniper's face would be affected. And because there wasn't really much in the way of surgery, because anesthesia was just, I don't remember how much, I don't think there was a lot of anesthesia available in the 1860s. It came along later. They made masks for these people. You know, they would shape masks and paint them and all. And so if they wore them, at least they didn't terrify everybody. But I think that's, you know, that's a fascinating aspect of the war, is what do you do with people who are not just wounded in their minds, but are made hideous, and, you know, their lives are never going to be, are never going to be worth living after the war if they survive, as long as they have these kinds of wounds.
Yeah. As you may recall in your reading, they, before the era of constructive surgery, they would construct masks to hide the wound. But people would see the mask and imagine what was behind it. So it was very difficult for those who were wounded. As far as anesthesia was concerned, it's an interesting story behind anesthesia. You're right. During the Civil War, there was virtually no anesthesia. I mean,
that was alcohol.
Alcohol, or bite down on this, what have you. And if someone suffered a wound to his arm or leg, if it shattered bone, that extremity was amputated. They had no other choice. But in the mid 1800s, there was a dentist in Atlanta, I think his last name was Crawford, who reported using ether to extract teeth from some of his patients. And this sort of caught on. And suddenly physicians started using ether so that they could do reconstructive surgery. And as a result, reconstructive surgery was done during the First World War, although it wasn't widely known. And still those people suffered greatly. And they continued to wear masks for years after that. Yeah. It was devastating to those people, absolutely devastating.
It's astonishing when you think, you know, basically just over 100 years later, we were able to come up with vaccines in a remarkable, you know, a remarkably short length of time to help deal with the pandemic that we have been in. When you think that, you know, people were wearing masks instead of having surgery just over 100 years ago, it's really amazing how far medicine has come. I think the story, Dr. Goldberg, is that Queen Victoria popularized the use of ether by having it for the birth of her last child, her ninth child.
Exactly right.
She agreed to have ether to help make the birth easier. And yeah, the other thing that happened somewhere in there is that puerperal fever, they finally figured out that if the midwives and the physicians would wash their hands, that puerperal fever could be greatly reduced or abolished, because there were many people who had successful deliveries, but then their children died because the babies died, and they often died because of infection. So again, you know, wasn't a lot we knew. But that's not what's going on in the Blue Diamond. We digressed here. Tell us about the diamond, because I've actually been to the De Beers mine in South Africa. You can take, there's a train called the Rovis Rail, which is a Victorian line that you can take from Pretoria to Cape Town. And as part of it, they go past the great De Beers diamond mine, and you get out and spend the afternoon there. They have a lot of security. If you're a tourist, they frisk you going in and out. And the mine is now tremendously deep. But of course, at the beginning, it wasn't, you know, it's come down.
They also, of course, carefully searched all the workers.
That's true.
They didn't smuggle diamonds out. But South Africa back in those days, literally had a monopoly on diamonds.
Yeah.
I mean, they were the world center for diamond production. And as you may have read, diamonds come in different colors. Mm-hmm. They can be pink, they can be yellow, they can be crystal, they can be blue. The blue diamonds, by the way, get their color because particles of boron are somehow stuck into the lattice of the diamond. And blue diamonds are very much desired because of their color and their sparkling appearance. So here comes this 3,000 carat diamond, which is exceptional. I mean, this is the second largest diamond ever discovered, second only to the Cullinan diamond. So it was to be a great gift to the King of England. It was to show the allegiance, but also to show the wealth of South Africa that would be transferred to England in need. So it served a bunch of purposes. And was a word let out that this diamond was stolen, it would be a terrible blow to morale. And they did everything to try to keep it quiet and did a pretty good job of it, I must say. But in the novel, of course, you have to insert some fiction with some fact. And someone once asked me, well, how much of it, this novel is really fact? And I said about 50%. And the person nodded and said, so 50% is fact and 50% is fiction. I said, that's correct. And they kind of looked at me waiting to say something more. And I finally added, you have to choose which is which.
Could be you. Have you ever seen the Cullinan diamond? It's in the crown jewels, the Royal Crown Jewels of England. So it's in the tower. And if you go to the tower, you can actually, where the beefeaters are guarding it and the whole bit, you can see the Cullinan diamond, which is enormous. But as I understand it, the value of diamonds comes not just from the size of the stone and all, but it's part of it is the skill of the cutter who, I don't even know how to explain it all, but anyway, creates the facets and so forth and shapes the diamond.
The cut is so important because if it's not done exactly correctly, it loses a lot of its value.
Yeah.
And in many instances, these large diamonds have to be cut into smaller diamonds and then polished. So it requires an artist to do so. And again, we're getting into my next novel, which I don't want to go into, but suffice it to say that during World War I, all the great diamond cutters and polishers were in Antwerp, Belgium.
Yeah.
And here we have a problem, again, just briefly about the novel I'm now working on, is Germany had occupied most of Belgium and Antwerp. And if you think you are going to get a big 3,000 calorie diamond past the German eyes, you better think again. So it's part of a story, but most of the diamond cutters came from Belgium, and the name which most of the cutters will talk about is Asher, and there's actually something called an Asher cut in which the diamond is square with shaved off corners. So make a long story short, during World War I and shortly thereafter, almost all diamonds were cut and polished in Belgium. So you had to cross the channel.
Very true. There's a wonderful collection of precious stones in the Smithsonian, many of whom were given by Marjorie Meriwether Post.
Yeah.
And years and years and years ago, when I was young and engaged, I went to a New Year's Eve party at, I don't remember what embassy it was in Washington, D.C. And I mean, I knew practically nothing. So, there I was. I had a wonderful dress that I was terrified was going to get dirty. And my fiance, and I were wandering around. And I finally sat down, and I sat next to this older woman. And I looked over at her, and she was just paved in stones. And I thought they were kind of dirty. And I thought, why is this woman wearing all these rhinestones? I mean, you know, it's all over her shoes and all over whatever it all is. And I was going, seriously, you know? And then I found out later it was actually Marjorie Merriweather Post wearing her, you know, this fortune in diamonds. But it also made me realize that if you have them, you have to keep them clean. Yes. You know, that, I mean, great jewelry like that requires attention. And but what made me nervous for your blue diamond was the idea that it would be so difficult to sell it. What would almost inevitably happen is that the thieves, if indeed these were real thieves, would have it cut down in order to make it saleable. And therefore, you know, the glory of the blue diamond would be lost forever, which has happened to a lot of, you know, to a number anyway, of great stones, is that they are so identifiable that somebody who's stolen them can't preserve them, but cuts them and or has them cut for resale.
Well, I think so.
I'm not going to talk about what happens to your blue diamond, but, you know, that was my first thought, was if it's really thieves, you know, the diamond is probably lost forever.
Well, yes. And part of the novel is that this diamond is going to have to be cut, and it's going to have to be made into smaller diamonds. And assuming this is the truth, then it's going to have to be done in Belgium.
Right, across the channel.
Across the channel. And at that time, of course, Germany was controlling a lot of the channel with their U-boats. And you might be interested to know that the Battle of Ypres, which I mentioned earlier, the Allies were very interested in pushing forward and defeating the Germans so they could reach the Belgian coast where the U-boats were stationed, because the U-boats were causing such havoc to the shipping. But the Germans held up and wouldn't let them get close to the coast. So that was a battle which cost 300,000 lives or wounded, what have you, with very little gain, very little. And all this.
So the question arises, you know, when the diamond is stolen, mysteriously stolen from the locked room, the impossible crime here, you know, is it because somebody covets the diamond, or is it because it can be turned into cash to support something, the Germans or some other enterprise, you know, because, I mean, it's valuable. And on the other hand, it's unique in itself as a stone. So I found that that created a certain amount of tension. So Joanna, does she follow in her famous father's footsteps and her methods of detection?
Oh, yes. She's very good. And when she investigates the theft of the diamond from the penthouse of the hotel, which is the fifth story of this hotel, and the question is, how did they get in? I mean, the windows were locked, the doors were locked, there were guards, security men in the hall, and the exit by the elevator. How'd they get in? And I won't give away a lot, but this is a rather interesting facet of the novel. The doorman at the hotel was somehow injured in that theft. And there's a doorman down five floors, and he suffers this terrible head wound. And initially it said, well, obviously the thief was making his exit and they got into a fight and what have you. But then Joanna investigates and finds out that right next to the wounded, and he was mortally wounded, by the way, doorman, was a spike, a metal spike. And Watson said, well, obviously the thief had a spike carrying around and used it as a weapon. And Joanna says, no, you don't carry a spike around as a weapon. That doesn't make sense. Let's find out about this spike. And they questioned people who were on the scene at the time, and they described this spike, which Joanna finds very fascinating because she knows what it is. It's a piton. It's a spike that's used by mountain climbers. So she says, that's how they got into the room. There was a mountain climber, somebody who knew how to climb mountains. And of course, the next question is, well, how do they open a window? And she solves that for them too. So we're dealing with thieves who are very sophisticated and expert, who know how to climb mountains, who know how to get into rooms without breaking windows. And the novel goes on.
It does indeed. So why is it that you decided to write about the daughter of Sherlock Holmes? Were you a Sherlockian yourself before you started this? Were you fascinated with Holmes and the whole world that Conan Doyle created?
It's an interesting story. I was fascinated by Sherlock Holmes. And as a lad, I had a book, one of these thick books that had all the adventures of Sherlock Holmes. And I had read them so many times that it was dog-eared. Pages were falling out. And then my brother and I used to watch on television movies of Sherlock Holmes with Basil Rathbone.
And Nigel Bruce, wasn't Nigel Bruce Dr. Watson?
It just was magic to me. And I never really thought about writing about it until, I guess it was 1980s. I was a professor at UCLA, and during my sabbatical year, I spent that year in London, and my flat was about 15 minutes away from where Sherlock Holmes lived. So I visited, et cetera, et cetera. And it stuck in my mind that what a shame that Sherlock Holmes didn't have offspring. What would have been like? And then, and this is rather circuitous route, but it's an interesting one. I was watching television, Masterpiece Theater, which I really enjoy. And they had a detective, British detective named Morse. And that was the name of the show, Detective Morse. And it was very good. I enjoyed it. And this was followed by another series, which I saw, which was called Endeavor. And I said, Endeavor Morse. This must be Detective Morse's son, who inherited his qualities and characteristics. And that's where the idea for the daughter of Sherlock Holmes came. Alas, I was later to find out that Endeavor was not the son of Morse, but Morse is a young detective. But that's all right. It was the impetus.
It's a wonderful series. And in fact, it's wrapping up. I think it starts this weekend with the last episodes that Sean Evans, who's playing Endeavor.
It's wonderful.
And Roger Allam. I have enjoyed it too. Although, I did think, having watched the last one, I've watched all of it, that sadly, that Morse is going, Endeavor is going to go into Morse's life. And Morse's life was productive, but not a super happy one. And, and if you watch the whole Morse series, he dies, unfulfilled. Dexter would get him right up to the point where maybe he would have a good life. And then, he died. So I found it a little hard to watch that penultimate Endeavor, thinking that, there wasn't going to be a lot of happiness or promise ahead for him. And I'll be interested to see how these last episodes go. But they've moved him along to the point where Morse starts. So, there's not an unlimited time frame for Endeavor, since he is young Morse growing up.
It's not only Endeavor, but the characters around him, like Sergeant, what's his name, Thursday, whatever his name is, or the superintendent of police. These are very interesting characters who all have their own miseries.
Mm-hmm. I love Thursday. I think Roger Allam as Thursday has been absolutely terrific.
And he's got a marriage, which is not the happiest, obviously. A daughter who is partly estranged. The superintendent of police, his wife had a widespread cancer malignancy. These people have problems, which
I don't think Colin Dexter was a very kind author to his characters. None of them was enormously happy. I actually enjoyed Sergeant Lewis a lot, which is when Morris dies, his faithful sidekick, Lewis. And he got a number of cases of his own. And I really liked those. He was a happier man. And, you know, there wasn't that shadow of Morse's unhappy end hanging over Lewis, because Morse had already died. So Lewis is moving forward. And I was hoping they would do more of them. I thought it was extremely well done. But it's interesting that in three different, completely different series with different casts and so forth, on Masterpiece, you've got the young Morse, and then you've got Morse himself, which went on for a really long time. And then you've got Sergeant Lewis. So it's a terrific tribute. I've often thought that it was partly because it was Oxford, you know, the magic of Oxford as much as the characters. What do you think?
I do. I think there's a certain magic to Oxford. Now, I traveled a fair amount when I lived in England, to Cambridge and to Oxford. But there was something about Oxford that was, I hate to use this as an analogy, but it was as if the buildings wanted to tell you a story. If you had time and sat, they would tell you a story. I always got that feeling at Oxford. And it's a
university. I spent a summer at Worcester College, and I loved being a student there and living in the college. But I often thought about the Dreaming Spires. I can't remember who it is, you know, that calls Oxford the City of Dreaming Spires. But there's so much history there. There's, you know, my tutor, Mr. Pitt, at Worcester College, lived in the abbot's 13th century quarters. And, you know, so when we would visit him, we went, Worcester College had terrible food. That's the thing I remember about it most. I nearly starved while I was at Worcester College. And so we used to sneak out to Brown's, which is a kind of wonderful restaurant in Oxford, and, you know, and eat, because if you ate in the college, despite all the drama and the, you know, the high table and all the tradition, if you watch Harry Potter, you know how that all goes. Food was just awful. But it was magical to walk across the, you know, out the back of the college and across the lawn to get to Mr. Pitt's quarters, because they ran in a series of buildings, and he had a garden also, because the land fell away. So there was this sort of raised garden next to, but the sad part, Leonard, was that it was only his to live in while he was, in fact, a don at Oxford. And his time there had come to an end, and it was his last summer teaching. And he was faced with the thought of having to pack up all of his books and all of his personal things, because the living itself and most of the furniture all belonged to the college. And, you know, he was going to have to redesign his life somewhere else and take his books with him. And I thought, how would you ever do that if you'd been living in the 13th century abbot's quarters? You know, in that kind of magical place, how would you ever transition to like an ordinary, you know, flat, as the British would say, an ordinary apartment somewhere else in England, or a little cottage? How would you do that?
It must have been terribly difficult. And again, living in Oxford, spending all of your days in Oxford, the magic rubs off on you. You really think you're part of it.
Well, that's true. But I mean, I think you'd feel like an exile when, you know, when you were time to retire. I mean, it's not like the Supreme Court justices where, you know, you have unlimited tenure. And so inevitably there's going to be that kind of a thing. But anyway, back to, so that's why you wrote it, is that you thought that Endeavor was the child of Morse, and that was such a good idea that Sherlock Holmes should have a child?
Yes. And of course, there was a question of whether it should be a son or a daughter.
Right.
And then I was thinking back and forth and back and forth. And I looked it up, and someone had written a novel about the son of Sherlock Holmes back 20 or 30 years ago. And it wasn't well received. And the more I thought about it, the more it appealed to me to let her be a woman, or let the child be a woman, because that would present problems for her. You have to remember, this is the Edwardian period, and women either married became a governess or maybe worked as a clerk in a flower shop, but women weren't detectives and women weren't policemen. There were very few women who were doctors or lawyers. I mean, they were subjected to a lower standard. And I kept thinking how difficult it must have been for her. But then again, if she's as bright as I'm going to make her, people will stand aside.
So you had to go into the Sherlock Holmes canon and figure out a woman suitable to be the mother, the daughter of Sherlock Holmes. And, you know, Irene Adler was really the only woman that Holmes hung out with. So what was your solution to this?
Well, what I did is I made her the daughter of Sherlock Holmes and Irene Adler.
Ah.
They had a one-night stand. The next morning, Irene Adler's gone. Sherlock Holmes is delighted. Good, stay away. 8.5 months later, she reappears at 221B Baker Street, pregnant. And she's come to see Sherlock Holmes because she needs help. Now, Sherlock Holmes is not going to be a father. That's not even beyond the wildest dream. But Sherlock loves to solve problems. And she has a real problem because she's suffering from the toxemia pregnancy. She's going to be dead in 2 weeks. And she wants the child to be looked after. Well, Sherlock Holmes says, let me see what I can do. So he meets with John Watson and they come up with a plan. The plan is that Irene Adler will give birth. The child will then be put up for adoption to a upper middle class family and her records will be sealed. So no one will ever know that she is the daughter of Sherlock Holmes. And some weeks later, Irene Adler gives birth to this beautiful daughter who she names Joanna. But Irene Adler gets to hold that baby only once and kiss her only once before she dies. And Watson lives up to the promise he made to Sherlock, and Joanna is adopted by a well-to-do physician and his wife, and the adoption records are sealed. She grows up in a wonderful environment. They love her. She's never had a better life. Most people would love to have the life she had, but she has a quirk. She loves mysteries. She reads every mystery book she can get her hand on, everything. She goes to plays and she decides who the villain is before the curtain drops on the first act. So she's got this inbred detectiveness in her. And the story takes off from there.
Well, her mother was pretty spectacular too. So, you know, the combination is great.
Yeah, Sherlock Holmes was outwitted, I think, by 5 people, but only one woman.
Right.
And that one woman was Irene Adler. Now, he never loved her. He didn't think badly or didn't say, oh, it's her, but he never called her by name. He always referred to her as the woman. so typical of Holmes.
I think Joanna has a distinguished lineage, and somehow or other, we won't spoil it, she becomes part of the Watson family. And then, you know,
it takes
becomes well known as the sleuth. And so Scotland Yard arrives, and the Blue Diamond is mysteriously disappeared, and the doorman is laid out with a metal spike, and, you know, chaos is reigning. Plus, there have been other robberies in London at these at 2 of the fashionable hotels anyway. Yeah. And the war is going on. So I find that, you know, Lestrade and the commissioner of Scotland Yard come knocking at Joanna's door. So it would have been a repeat of what happened with her father so often, was that they would, you know, reluctantly come to ask him. It's amazing how iconic Sherlock Holmes is and how many people have done interesting things with him.
It's remarkable. As you may know, there is no character who has been featured in films, television, cinema, what have you, no characters, many times a Sherlock Holmes.
That's true. I mean, and everybody can recognize, you know, the Deerstalker and the Meerschaum pipe and the,
everything.
You know, the prologue. I mean, Poirot is well known, but not nearly as much so as Holmes. So what fun for you that you get to wander around in this universe, although you have actually had to update it. So, you know, Sherlock Holmes was a Victorian and now she's in the war, and eventually the 1920s in England were very different. So it'll be, and she's young enough to, you know, move forward and adapt. Of course, the fact that she's a woman means she didn't have to fight in the war, which was a really good decision on your part.
Right, but you have to remember that she now has equipment, tools, techniques which were not available for Sherlock Holmes.
Right.
During Sherlock's time, fingerprints were in their infancy and not thought of very highly. During Sherlock Holmes' era, x-rays were just now coming into being. So she was part of a transition and new science was coming up and she used it.
And absolutely. Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I think part of the fascination of Holmes is the beginnings of forensic science. You know, yeah. Fingerprints were the guy in Paris in 1903, I can't remember his name. Yeah. But a lot of this evidence wasn't even acceptable in court.
They wouldn't. It was not admissible.
Right.
But not admissible.
So crime solving has come a long way from the Bow Street Runners that, you know, are... Just like spying, I mean, we could go all the way back to Sir Francis Walsingham, who was Queen Elizabeth's spy master, and he was actually like the CIA. He ran a fabulous group of spies, one of whom might have been Christopher Marlowe, for example, that, you know, that's a question that still preoccupies people. Why did Christopher Marlowe die in the cavern in Deptford? You know, was it a gay romance gone bad, or was it a rival playwright, or, you know, was it in fact because he was a spy? There are just all kinds of things going on. So
probably the earliest MI5.
Yeah, no, absolutely true. And, you know, Elizabeth, there were so many threats to England from the outside, Spain in particular, but not just Spain. There was a constant question of, you know, other heirs to the throne or, you know, various things happening. So we're all preoccupied with British history. And I have to tell you, Leonard, there's a wonderful author called Sulari Gentle, who I had the pleasure of editing until we sold Poison Pen Press. And she has written a series of books set in the 1930s with Australian protagonists. And what I learned from her was what went on in the 30s in Australia and to some degree New Zealand. You know, there were Nazi plots, there was communism, there was, you know, the same stuff that was going on in Europe, but we're just not that familiar with it. We're so Eurocentric, most of us, that we are oblivious, I think. I was to a great degree to the kinds of challenges that the 1930s, well, the war, because the Australians served valiantly in World War I.
Oh, yeah.
You know, particularly at Gallipoli, there was a terrible slaughter of Australian and New Zealand soldiers, just awful. Anyway, you might be interested in reading them because she's very, very good about the history. And I think it's good to remember that, you know, the whole world was affected in the 1930s. We think today that the war in the Ukraine, you know, surrounding all of us is something new, but it really isn't.
Europe has been at war with one another for so long.
Forever.
I'm certain that the periods of war are far longer than the periods of peace.
I mean, and if it wasn't territorial advancement or whatever, it was religious wars. I mean, you know, the whole history of Europe is one long war. You're absolutely right. Fascinating stuff. Patrick, why don't you come and join us? Because we can't say anything much more about the Blue Diamond without ruining the plot.
An interesting thing I did notice, I was watching something on television some weeks or months ago, whenever, It was really not very good, but it shows you how endearing Sherlock Holmes is to us 100 years later, in which a junior detective comes up with a clue that's very obvious, and his superior looks at him and says, oh, oh great, great job, Sherlock. I mean, we use his name in so many ways and fashions. It just struck me over 100 years ago.
Absolutely. Well, we know some serious Sherlockians, Leslie S. Klinger, Laurie King, Otto Penzler, fellow bookseller. You know, there's a whole Baker Street Irregular Society that meets every year in New York in January. And I mean, these people are really serious about it all.
So write something that's not true about Sherlock, and you will hear from those Sherlockians. they will write it. Well, this never happened. Well, where did you get this from? And you know, I want to write back and say, no, you don't understand. It's fiction. But to them, it's not fiction.
I think that's a tribute to the incredible power of the creation, of Conan Doyle's creation, that people can actually take him as a real person. And during the missing years, they can decide, you know, did he go to Tibet? Did he go to North America? You know, what did he do? In the way that you would try to research the life of, you know, an actual real person where all that had happened. Do we have any questions, Patrick? I can't hear you. Patrick, you're muted.
Oh, I'm muted.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. There really aren't any, let me see here, any new questions that have come in. Let's see. Well, Mark asks, who is the woman Sherlock Holmes gets pregnant, or did he adopt his daughter? You kind of covered that. That's Irene Adler. I had a question for you though, Leonard. Do you have a favorite of all the different film adaptations? Some of them have been modern reinterpretations of the character. There's the classic Basil Rathbone and Jeremy Brett. Do you have a favorite for movies or TV?
Yeah, Jeremy Brett by far. He was perfect. He was absolutely perfect. And I think Watson in that episode was rather sharp. Not the dunce that people like to think of him as being. For example, when he was with Basil Rathbone, he wasn't a very bright guy, etc. But with Jeremy Brett, he was rather sharp. And you have to remember, if you look back at Conan Doyle's novels, Sherlock Holmes used Watson as a sounding board. He would have a thesis or an idea or hypothesis. He would try to pass it by Watson, who was good enough to point out its promise or its flaws. So the Jeremy Brett was just 5-star in my estimation.
They were wonderful. And ironically, like Morse, he died of a heart attack way too young.
Well, it reminds me, one of the great British actors who you're probably aware of, Robert Shaw. Mm-hmm. He was just a fantastic actor. Yeah, he was in his early 50s, and he was driving along in England, and suddenly he got chest pain. And for reasons unknown, he stopped his car, got out, and began running, as if he was going to try to outrun death. And of course, he ended up with a massive heart attack and dropped dead, which I often think of as quite remarkable that he picked the time in place of his demise. Very few of us have that choice.
That's true. Yeah. And England has produced some extraordinary actors, I think, you know, over the...
They all start on the stage. They all come from the Royal Shakespeare stage. We don't have that anymore. The fellow who lives across the way from me is, his name is Will Patton, a very good actor. And he was telling me about his chats with Gene Hackman. And Gene Hackman says, if you don't come off the Broadway stage, you're not really an actor. And of course, he was talking about the likes of Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau and Henry Fonda and what have you, because that's where they learned how to act. And in Britain, they all come off of the Royal Shakespeare stage. That's why they're so bloody good.
Well, they really are amazing. And Holmes is a fascinating character. I'm glad you had such a good time with it. And it's cheering to hear, because that's the question I usually ask, what are you doing next? But we already know from this conversation that Leonard is working on yet a new book, and the war is not yet over, and it'll be fun to see how they're going. So Patrick, if there are any other questions, can we say goodnight and thank you very much to Leonard for joining us again?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask about, I know these books have done so well, it's been great. But we first met you when you wrote medical thrillers, isn't that right?
Correct.
Do you have any of those kind of that you're working on, or are those kind of on the back burner for a while?
Well, I put them on the back burner, but I have to admit that I have one of those completed novels, rough draft, sitting, waiting for the right time. And that medical thriller series that went through 9 novels, by the way, and the heroine was Joanna Blaylock, a modern day forensic pathologist. And Joanna Blaylock is the great granddaughter of the Joanna in my Sherlock Holmes novel. Uh-huh. So there's a connection.
Generational sleuthing. I love it.
And I talked to the editor. I said, you know, Pete, my editor, Pete Wolverton, is just a marvelous editor. You know, I've got this novel about a modern day Joanna. He said, I don't want to hear it. You're doing so well with what we got. You hold it. Just keep it where it's at for now. So I'm going to do that. I think that's good advice.
Well, as long as you're having fun with it, that's a really important thing.
That's an important thing. You know, it's this mystery writer, Walter Mosley, who I really enjoy reading. He said, writing a novel was like being in a hotel in a strange city that you've never visited, and you step outside for a walk, you just don't know where it's going to take you. And that's what writing a novel is like. That's the joy of it.
Well, thank you once again for signing books for us. We really do appreciate it, Leonard. And as Patrick pointed out, we only have a few left. Beautiful cover, by the way, on this one, I think. So if you're interested in a little time with Sherlock, well, his descendants and all, here's your chance. So good night, everybody. Thank you very, very much for joining us.
Nice seeing you, Patrick, and Barbara.
Nice to see you too.
Joy to see you.
And you too, Leonard. Thanks very much. Next year. Right.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.